This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We begin with China. You might say we begin and end with China these days, from the futuristic, gleaming China of the 2008 Olympics. To the welcoming commercial China of airline commercials crossed with the strident, nasty rhetoric about China in the U.S. presidential campaign. Well, I think you know what I mean.
East Hemisphere.
West Hemisphere.
This is the era of a global community.
I have my own time zone.
On day one, I will label China a currency manipulator.
Governor Romney invested in companies that were pioneers of outsourcing to China.
We'll also make sure that we have trade relations with China that work for us.
If it's following the rules.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown. A lot of contradictions there. It's the last line of the movie of the same name, Chinatown. But China, forget it? I don't think so. China is no longer any kind of town these days, this China of the 21st century. By 2025, China will have 219 cities with a population of over a million people. Europe will maybe have 35. By themselves, six of the 31 individual provinces in China would be ranked in the top 32 industrial nations in the world. Currency manipulator, rule breaker, job stealer. China's been called a lot of names in this presidential campaign. But how well do we really understand this country of 1.3 billion? Joining us now is Jonathan Fenby, author of the new book, Tiger Head, Snake Tales, China Today, How It Got There, and Where It's Heading. It's great to have you here in the studio. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Good day, and it's very good to be back here.
What have you made of the rhetoric in the presidential campaign? On one level, it's expected. On another level, it can't be productive. How are the Chinese seeing this?
Well, I think it was pretty much expected. It's pretty much par for the course, to hold China up as a scapegoat. I would say for a lot of things that perhaps are the problems are more in this country than from China. Of course, there's nothing new with the perceived China threat. China has been growing very fast for the last 30 years. And part of that growth has essentially been based on either attracting jobs, which used to be done in the industrialized countries of the West, and on selling goods to those countries of the West. Because China itself needed technology, it needed imported technology, and it also needed external markets to sell its goods to, because basically it's too poor at home to sustain the kind of economy which its leaders want to build up. So inevitably there are clashes. China is the rising power. The U.S. is the superpower. It's inevitable that you're going to get friction between them.
I said, just to be deliberately provocative, because as you know, that's what I like to do here, is that the U.S. presidential campaign doesn't matter compared with the power shift that's going to take place in China just a few days later after November 6th.
Yes, indeed. The Chinese Communist Party, which is the body that runs China. There's a government in China, but it's less important than the Communist Party. And one must always remember that. This is an old-fashioned Leninist system, the last one in any major country on earth. That Communist Party will hold its five-yearly Congress starting on November the 8th, 2 days after the U.S. presidential election. And there, you can use the verb you like. That Congress will confirm the new leadership of China, which will be either seven or nine people. We're not sure of the exact number. They'll almost certainly all be men. And this is what's called the fifth generation of Chinese leaders. These are younger people in their 50s. The outgoing crew are all in their late 60s. They've reached their term limit or age limit. So this new group of people will come in. And one of the extraordinary and slightly frightening things about this change of transition is how little we know about them. You have Romney and Obama debating, television, newspapers full of stuff every day, policy debates and so on. In China, there's been just about no open policy debate. They don't go in for that kind of thing. I mean, the idea of the Chinese leaders, and there is rivalry at the top, holding a kind of televised debate like you've had in this country is just unthinkable.
Absolutely unthinkable. We're talking with Jonathan Fenby, author of Tiger Head, Snake Tales, China Today, How It Got There, and Where Is It Heading. I want to come back to the issue of who are the names to watch as we come forward and think about this power shift. But let's talk a little bit about what we can see in China today. Among the facts that we learn from your book is that the Chinese love Buicks for reasons that have nothing to do with the way they look or anything about the features that you can buy with them. There's the largest gene sequencing lab on Earth being built in China. There's a billion yuan being spent to manipulate the weather in this huge plan to actually change the climate in China. Talk a little bit about these huge initiatives and strange, wonderful facts that we don't really know about China here in the
US. Well, that's why I took the first part of my title, Tiger Head. It's this huge, great tiger head, China. Multiply anything by 1.3 billion, which is the number of people living in China, and obviously you get a lot of big figures. Add to that the fact that the Chinese authorities, the government, has got a lot of money, mainly coming from exports and trade, and they are willing to spend it, building up China, building high-speed train networks, which is the biggest in the world, but that's been built just in a few years. Airports all over the place sprouting up, eight-lane highways, and you go to big cities, not just the biggest cities like Shanghai and Beijing, but also the cities inland now, and they're just full of skyscrapers, concrete and glass everywhere. The whole place is kind of, you know, having a growth, it's on adrenaline from that point of view. But that brings with it certain problems because in some ways China is moving too far too fast. It's trying to do things which it hasn't perhaps got the real capacity to do. The high-speed train network I talked about, very impressive. I've been on those trains. They're tremendous and so on. But last year there was a bad train crash, about 40 people killed in eastern China, and that was appears to have been because they were running the trains too fast and the technology wasn't up to as good as it should have been.
One of the things we don't know about China is the real swirl of opposition forces, of people who believe that the society should be organized very, very much differently. In your chapter, The Giant Hot Pot, you talk about the number of apocalyptic messianic groups inside China. We know about Falun Gong. Yeah. Maybe Americans know about Falun Gong because of the protests that often happen outside of the Chinese embassies and consulates around the U.S. But there are also groups like the Three Grades of Servants, Eastern Lightning Shouters, the Spirit Church, the Disciplines Association, the Crying Faction. Explain a little bit of where these groups come from and how significant they are.
Well, this goes way back into, like a lot of things, it goes way back into Chinese history because China has always had a top-down, undemocratic form of rule. And that leads at local level to these secret groups, which, if they were known about, would often be persecuted, arrested, imprisoned, and liquidated. So you had this kind of group of sects, which goes all through Chinese history. And at the moment, those kind of groups that you've talked about are often linked with religion, often with underground Christian groups too. But in some cases, they are, if you like, messianic, end-of-the-world cults. In other cases, frankly, they're just kind of gangs of people who are profiting and using their so-called beliefs and ideology to oppress other people.
But, of course, because of the scale of China, they have huge numbers of members, and it's hard to evaluate their political power. Let's talk a little bit about the dollar trap. What is this and how is it contributing to the potential for China to not really be able to keep the lid on here?
Well, China, as we've said, has built up these big trade surpluses over the last 30 years, and that brings in a lot of dollars, which China earns. But China controls the currency. It controls the whole monetary system very closely indeed. And these dollars are not put out into the Chinese economy. If you're an exporter from China, you earn dollars, you exchange them through the central bank for yuan, the Chinese currency, but then the authorities are left holding all these dollars. So what they've done is they've bought a lot of U.S. securities, particularly T-bonds, more than 1.5 trillion of U.S. Securities. So they've got all this, but they're stuck with it because if they started to sell it, the bottom would fall out of the dollar and their holdings will be worth even less.
Which means that even though the popular notion is that the Chinese are doing some favor to the United States by lending and supporting the federal deficit, in fact, they have no choice but to continue lending to the U.S.
So long as they keep these monetary controls in place in China, they're stuck with this. And it's the famous old thing of John Maynard Keynes saying, you know, if you owe your bank $100, you may have a problem. If you owe your bank $100 million, it's the bank that's got the problem.
Let's talk a little bit about Deng Xiaoping. He really created the conditions for what we are seeing today. Did he envision what we're seeing in China today? What was the key insight this Chinese leader had?
Well, his key insight was political. We always talk about China in economic terms. But Deng Xiaoping, who was a lifelong communist, he joined the Communist Party as a teenager when he was a student in France. And he was also a great Chinese nationalist, patriot. And when he won out in the power struggle that followed the death of Mao Zedong, that was at the end of the 70s, Deng had this insight that China was in a terrible state after the Cultural Revolution, after all Mao's mad, adventurous schemes. China was on its knees at that point, and the Communist Party was also imploding very fast, ironically, because of Mao's move against the party leadership at that point. And Deng wanted to make China a great power and wanted to make the Communist Party powerful again. And he chose economic growth as the way of doing that, and freed up certain sectors of the economy. The state-controlled public sector in China is still extremely important. Don't think that this is private enterprise on steroids, as some people do. And Deng, that succeeded. That worked. And it's made China into the rising superpower, and it's put the Communist Party firmly in control of this huge country.
And of course, Deng viewed the June 4th uprising as a blip on the road to prosperity. Many Chinese view it the same way. But in terms of human rights, can they sustain this suppression of human rights in China indefinitely?
Yes and no. Yes, they can in the formal way of, for instance, at the moment, we've had a big campaign throwing human rights lawyers into prison, which I go into in my book a great deal, suppressing all kinds of organized opposition. The Nobel Peace Prize winner is in jail for 11 years for having advocated democracy. You've seen Ai Weiwei, what's happened to him, many, many other cases.
There's a word for it, being disappeared.
Being disappeared, and you know that is, happens to anybody who is seen as organizing public opposition to China. On the other hand, there's no doubt that in particularly the last decade, individual Chinese, particularly those living in cities, particularly the middle class, now enjoy a far greater freedom than they've probably ever had before, and certainly more than they've ever had under communism. And it's that, and I go into this a lot in the book, it's this whole social movement and social evolution in China, which is the really challenging thing for the communist regime, which remains stuck in this hermetic, opaque leadership style, which I mentioned earlier on, with the change transition in the top leadership of this incredibly important country taking place behind closed doors. We get leaks, we can interpret what's happening, but there's no public opening for that. And that fits increasingly badly with this rapidly evolving society. 70 million Chinese go abroad every year. They use the internet. They know what's going on in the world. There's a crunch coming.
Is Wang Yang the name to watch coming forward?
Well, Wang Yang,
very quickly, we've got to go.
He runs Guangdong in the south. He's the reformist of the leadership. But the latest story is he's going to be blocked, rising to the very top.
Jonathan Fenby, author of Tiger Head, Snake Tales, China Today, How It Got There and Where It Is Heading. Call us at 877-8-MYTAKE to weigh in on this conversation or anything else you hear.